redactions. He has to keep in mind that he has a responsibility to turn over exculpatory material. So he may edit out witnesses who are going to give testimony that hurts my client, but to the extent that they're exculpatory, he has a responsibility to turn them over. This only came out through cross-examination. It wasn't turned over to me prior to trial. And as I sit here today, I'm not confident that the name was turned over to me. We look in the transcript, and you see that it says Albert Griffin was the guy who made that statement. And then you look in the brief on pages 12 and 13 in the state's response, they refer to him as Gwynn. So I don't know if Gwynn is the guy that made that statement or if it's Albert Griffin, but I don't think that it's fair in the middle of a trial to be given this information.
Was there any application for a mistrial? Your Honor, this is a showstopper. This is so important. We have to start over. I need time to inquire and interview this witness, find this witness.
No, there wasn't.
Well, what is your response to the issue of waiver then?
Well, we're in the middle of a trial, and I'm not sure that the remedy at that point would be, all right, let's stop everything and see if we can find this person out and interview him and so forth. I understand what Your Honor is saying, and perhaps that would have been a good idea, but you're in the middle of a trial, and you're in the middle of cross-examination, and you get surprised like this. And even now, as I sit here today, I'm not confident in saying to the court it's Albert Griffin or if it's Gwynn.
Can I get one factual matter clear for myself? You said a moment ago that you didn't get this information until the middle of trial. Are you referring to the identity of the witness or the statement itself? Because my understanding was that you got a pile of police reports that before the trial that included the description of this person's statement to the police, but the person's name was blacked out. So is it correct that you had the information, all that you didn't have at the time of trial was the person's name?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I had the police report. I didn't have the officer's notes, but what is attached in the appendix is what I received. I received the police report with the name redacted. And I just took the assumption that when they're referring to William Witt, that continued on with William Witt. Also, the name Albert Griffin never surfaced in this case. He was not somebody who lived with Kevin Rafferty. He was not someone who was a friend. I don't know where he came from. We never heard from him before in any involvement in this case, and I don't know how his name surfaced. There was references in the police report. William Witt was a friend of Rafferty. They were close friends. They lived together. They worked together. And there was a previous reference in the police report about William Witt overhearing a telephone conversation.
Let's go back. And can you just succinctly state the Brady violation? You got the statement with the name redacted. Is the Brady violation redacting the name?
Yes.
Now, if you've got a statement that looks to you like Brady material, I go back to my earlier question. Why isn't it fair to say if the state discloses something that's Brady material without a name, and the defense has to say to the state, please give me the name also?
Because I don't think I think they have an affirmative duty to give you the information. I don't think it works where we say, give us the Brady material, and they give us a little bit, and then they say, well, give us more.
Well, isn't the real problem in this case your erroneous assumption that the redacted name was Witt?
That is a problem, and that wouldn't have happened if they had provided me with the name. And if I hadn't gone through the cross-examination and gone down the path that I did with William Witt, that this disclosure would have been made.
Well, isn't it sometimes rather nuanced whether information or material is, in fact, Brady material. And once it became clear during the course of the trial itself that the defense viewed this as relevant to the defense, there was a disclosure of the name, wasn't there? Or are you suggesting that the prosecutors should have recognized when they produced all of the police reports that of all the names in this document or these documents that were redacted, and apparently several, this was one that could not be redacted under Brady?
Yes. I think when they are going through the police reports and they are redacting names, some names they chose not to redact, some they did. I think when they do that, they have to make a determination in their mind, is this witness exculpatory? If this is an exculpatory witness, it doesn't get redacted. If it's a different witness who is giving evidence that's going to be hampering to the defense, well, then they'll make a decision under the Victim's Bill of Rights or whatever, if they think that the witness may be in danger, then they redact it. But if it's a exculpatory witness, I don't think they hide that name. I think they make that determination, and they don't edit it out, and they give it to you. And as I indicated earlier, I'm not sure to this date whether I've been provided with the correct name, only because of the references that are in the brief. They refer to it at one point as Albert Griffin, at another point as Gwen. I don't know if we have two people. I don't know if there's a mistake or a typo, but to be given, well, I don't know if it's a correct name or not, but I'm in the middle of trial.
Can you help me understand how would the disclosure of this name resulted in a different outcome at trial?
Well, if Austin had threatened to harm Rafferty and I produced that witness, who overheard that conversation, and perhaps that witness could lead to other witnesses who overheard that conversation, then it becomes a question. I mean, just because Robinson makes a statement, and in part of that statement he says that he shot Austin, I don't think that's the sum total of the case. I understand it's very strong evidence, but we don't close up our books and walk out of the courtroom. The jury still has to weigh the evidence.
And did Robinson ever deny shooting Austin?
Yes. In his first statement to the police, or in the beginning of his first statement to the police.
After he admitted shooting Austin, for whatever reason, and did he ever deny that, or that was his final position?
He never took the witness stand. He started off in the interview in Philadelphia with the police. He started off saying that he never got out of the car, and he said that Austin was the shooter. And then as every time he tried to give that explanation, the police officer would cut him off and then bring him back to a different story. And then finally, over a period of time, he said what he said. He said that he.
So if we look at it from the jury's point of view, they see an initial statement where he denies shooting Austin. And then he says, okay, I did shoot him. And he has different explanations. But from the jury's point of view, it went from I didn't shoot him to I did shoot him with an explanation.
Right.
And that's what was presented to the jury.
Right. So it goes to a matter of degrees.
Right, you have about 4.5 minutes left. You want to address your second argument or save your time?
I'll do it very quickly. This involves that Timothy Austin gives an out-of-court statement, which is pretty lengthy. He gives another out-of-court statement, and then he testifies in court. When he testifies, there's inconsistencies between his first out-of-court statement and his in-court testimony. I wanted to ask the police officer who was party to that conversation about the inconsistencies. And as you can see, we got into a kind of the morass of 11 Delaware Code, Section 3507, and how that was going to be done. Timothy Austin was in the courthouse. He was subject to being rehabilitated. I wanted to
now, ask, timing, if these questions that you were asking, was this during the state's case or your own?
I was going to call the detective in my case, and I wanted to ask her about what Austin had said. And I told that to the trial judge. And the ruling was it was hearsay. I wanted to impeach Austin through that witness. And the prosecutor thought that was improper. My reason for doing this was I had two parties to a conversation. One of them was a very hostile witness. That was Timothy Austin. The other one was a police officer who was less hostile. To get to the impeaching inconsistencies, I wanted to do that with the less hostile witness, the police officer, rather than the hostile witness, Timothy Austin.
And the inconsistent statement that was not in evidence at this point?
You mean the tape? No, that was not in evidence, and I didn't want to put it in evidence because there was a lot of testimony and statements in there that hurt my client. I wanted to get to the impeaching evidence and not simply play the whole tape or put on a hostile witness to get to that impeaching evidence. I wanted to use, of the two witnesses that were available, I wanted to use the one who was less hostile, which was the police officer. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Donovan.
Good morning. If it please the court. Beginning with the Brady issue, the state takes issue with a number of portions of this argument. First of all, whether or not the materials that were turned over, which, by the way, were turned over in February of 07 and trial was not until April of 09, whether these materials were in any way confusing. And in addition to the detective supplement report, which is in the defendant's appendix, the actual report of Detective Grant, who did the interview with this Albert Griffin, is there also, and at B40 of the state's appendix, it seemed very clear that PC is blanked out. There's a large gap between the previous interview, which is with Witz, and Witz's name is not blanked out at all. His address is, but his name is not, because Witz is named in the indictment. So there's no sense in blanking him out. And we are constrained, of course, by 9403 of Title 11 to do this. So we blanked out. So that's blanked out. PC, person contacted, and the address. And then you start there at the bottom of B40 with the statement of this individual who is Albert Griffin.
Well, let's just stop there. I assume the point you're trying to make is if the defense was assuming the redacted name was Witz, that's not logical because Witt's name wasn't redacted anywhere else, so why would it be the redacted name?
That's precisely what I'm trying to point out. There's really no reason to assume this is a continuation of the interview with Mr. Witz. Again, the Brady issue was not raised, but even assuming the court mentioned that how do you know whether it's Brady material or not? And I would just like to say, to an extent, Brady is in the eye of the beholder. And we are not privy to the defendant's theory of the case. That Austin and Rafferty disliked each other was simply not a matter of dispute. This was over a young lady that Austin, by whom Austin had a child, and now Rafferty was in essence living with that young lady and raising the child as his own. They disliked each other. Nobody disputed that. And so as we're going through this,
so was there other evidence of that at the trial?
This was brought out through the testimony of Heather Reed, who was Rafferty's girlfriend and was Austin's mother, And in the statement of facts, as a matter of fact, in the appellant's opening brief, it goes into that portion of the case in some detail. But and also, Witts testified before Austin at trial. Austin's the one who supposedly made the threat. So Austin was there. He was on the witness stand, and if defense counsel, even without the person who overheard the threat present, could very easily have cross-examined Austin. Did you make the threat? And if Austin denied it, then you could find the witness, this Albert Griffin, and, you know, demand he be brought into trial to contradict the testimony of the denial of witness Austin. So there were many options here. I mean, defense counsel could have asked in this 14-month period before trial for us to disclose that, and if we refused, could have moved the court for disclosure.
Austin testified in the state's case.
I'm sorry?
Austin testified for the state.
Yes, Austin testified for the state.
As I understand what you're saying, on cross-examination, Austin was not asked about the threat.
That's correct.
And he was not asked about his prior inconsistent statements to the police officer.
All that, which, of course, leads naturally to argument number two. This is a statement made by Austin. Made that August 07 to Detective Smith, the chief investigating officer. It was recorded. The recording was handed over to defense counsel, who by the time of trial had made a transcript of the statement, which is contained in the appendix. The statement was, in the main, consistent with his in-court testimony, and we never introduced it into evidence under 3507 because there was really no reason to. There were some inconsistencies, no doubt. No doubt. I don't deny that. But Austin took the stand. Defense counsel had the statement. He had a transcript of the statement. And it would seem to be consistent with all the rules of evidence, 3507, the so-called jinx material, and Delaware Rule of Evidence 613, I believe it is, that you start out talking or examining or introducing evidence of a prior statement with the declarant who made the statement, especially when the declarant is there as a witness at trial, is on the witness stand, and you have the opportunity, full and fair, to examine the witness on that statement. And if the witness denies making the statement, of course you can bring in extrinsic evidence, then call Detective Smith and say, oh, no, he did make this statement, although in this case the statement is recorded, so he can't very well deny saying what he did. But the witness you begin with in this effort to bring the statement or parts of the statement into evidence is with the witness who made the statement, the declarant.
Well, let me interrupt you.
I mean,
obviously that is the quote-unquote normal way an attorney is likely to do that. But as I understand this, defense counsel was not interested in introducing the prior statement into evidence as affirmative evidence standing on its own under 3507. Rather, what defense counsel wanted to do is to impeach Austin as a credible witness by showing that he had made inconsistent statements. And if you're impeaching somebody, you're not putting the impeaching evidence, the impeaching information into evidence. You're just asking him the question, didn't you say X a week ago, right?
Yes.
Why can't a defense counsel decide that they'd rather do that with someone else who heard the statement and was there when he made the statement? Because, again, it's not being offered for its truth. It's only being offered to show that this isn't the same thing he said in court today. Where is the inherent infirmity with trying to do that?
Well, it's actually, the inherent infirmity is that it's hearsay coming from somebody else.
But it's only hearsay if it's offered for the truth, isn't it?
Brought in for the truth of the statement itself, that there was, say, a fourth party in the van, in the car when we came down, named Herb, which is the only real discrepancy I can see between the testimony and his
prior
statement.
But what if it's not being offered for the truth? It's only being offered to show that this witness said something different a week ago or a month ago or whenever it was. So therefore, jury, you know, you really shouldn't believe this witness. He says whatever he feels like saying.
Well,
so we don't know. We don't know which story is true. We're not telling you which story is true. We're just telling you this witness makes inconsistent statements. Why would it be hearsay to have the police officer answer a question about did he make a statement along these lines when he spoke to you?
Well, that would be Delaware Rule of Evidence 613. If you want to impeach the statement with a witness with the prior statement, you have to begin with the witness who made it and give the witness a chance to explain or deny why he made the statement. And that's typical of the Jenks Act, Jenks material, Jenks versus United States, that you begin with the witness who made the statement. The witness has a chance to explain or deny the statement before you bring in extrinsic evidence, which would be the statement itself, or the witness, in this case, Detective Smith, who made the statement. But you always begin with the witness who made the statement, rather than do an end run around that witness and try to get it in through another witness. And the reason for that, I think, is quite clear, because, yes, the witness who made the statement, the declarant, may very well be able to explain why there is that discrepancy. Now, of course, if I'm defense counsel, I don't want to give the witness the chance to explain the discrepancy. I want to talk to a witness without any knowledge whatsoever of what's in the background there, no knowledge of the facts at all, Detective Smith, and say, Detective Smith, did the witness say this? And Detective Smith will say, yes, the witness said that. And that's the end of it. Oh, there's a discrepancy, and we never allow the one who made the statement to explain why there's a discrepancy. Why, Detective Smith, did Mr. Austin say there was a fourth person in that van named Irv? And Detective Smith will say, well, yes, Mr. Austin did say that, and that's it. Now, if you ask that of Mr. Austin could say, no, I never said that, in which case Detective Smith can contradict him, or Mr. Austin would say, yes, I did say that, I was lying, I was trying to distance myself from this even more. There really was no other person there. I lied, that's all there is to it. But our rules of evidence, and particularly 6113, demand that before impeaching a witness with a prior statement, you give that witness a chance to explain the statement or deny making it. But you always bring it up to the witness, the declarant, the witness who is the declarant, before you go to extrinsic evidence, another witness or the recording itself. So no, it doesn't have to be brought in through 3507, the whole thing. But you can question a defendant either through standard Jenks or through 613 about certain aspects of that statement.
But even under 3507, you have to call the witness.
Even under 30, if you want to bring the whole statement in, of course. Or
even
redacted,
part of it, don't you?
Even part of it. Under 3507, which is now under our rules of evidence in the criminal case, the exclusive way to get a prior statement of a witness in evidence, you have to do it through the witness, and according to this court's many cases this court has addressed on 3507, and there's a certain way you have to go about it, and if you vary from that way, you do so at your peril. But you always start with the witness who made the statement, questioned about the statement, whether the statement was voluntarily made, testimony, of course, about the incident itself. That was not a problem here. Austin testified at length about the incident. My colleague said in that Robinson, in his statement to the police, and said that at one point Austin was the shooter. I don't believe he ever did say that. Robinson's statement started out, well, I've never been to Delaware. Well, yeah, I did pass through Delaware once on my way to Washington. Well, yeah, I did go down that day with Austin to do the drug deal, but I didn't have a gun. Well, I had a gun, but it was a BB gun. I always carry a BB gun. Well, yeah, I really had a gun, but I didn't intend to use it, of course. And there's no doubt about that. He did not intend to use that gun. But, yeah, Austin and I planned to rob the guy. Okay, Austin gave me the gun. Then, okay, we were in the car. He never really explains why he did this. But when Austin's in the car, or when Robinson's in the car sitting directly behind Witz, and Rafferty and Austin get out of the car to go around the back to get the marijuana, for some reason, Robinson pulls the gun out, holds it to Witz's head, and robs Witz of his gold chain and two cell phones or something. And but then, when that's seen by everybody, then Rafferty and Austin get into this big fight, all right? And according to Robinson, you know, I saw that Rafferty, the victim, was getting the best of Austin. All I wanted to do was get out of there. By the way, he grabbed the bag with the marijuana, too. And he said, so I closed my eyes. I pointed the gun at Rafferty, closed my eyes, and shot. So that's it. He never said that Austin was the shooter. Austin was in this fight. His initial explanation, there was somebody else in the car. Maybe it was the driver. The driver was also named Kevin. The driver shot him. But eventually he agreed that he himself did the shooting. But I don't believe anywhere in that does he place the blame on Austin himself.
Well, doesn't Rafferty at least implicitly do that in his?
Rafferty, of course, is dying, and he mentions Austin's name twice. The first time to Witz. Witz doesn't know Austin's real name, so Witz asks. Rafferty as he's dying. What is Ghost's name? All right, that's how Witz knows him as Ghost. And Rafferty replies, Stephen Austin. And then the officer arrives and says, who did this to you? Now, Rafferty does not know Robinson. Never seen him before, has no idea. Obviously, Austin's involved, so he says the one name he knows, which is Austin's name. The officer did not specifically, and of course, the man is dying. I mean, he's just about gone. He doesn't have a chance to go into a big explanation about this. He gives him the one name that he knows, which is Stephen Austin, and that's how it was argued to the jury, and that's actually how Witz explained it. Witz was actually questioned about that too on cross-examination, and the answer he gave was, precisely the same one I gave. You know, the guy's dying, you know, the Austin's the only one he knew. That's what he said. I see my yellow light is on, and I believe I have covered all the points that I wanted to make. If the court has any further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel talked about, I guess, the scope of the cross-examination of Timothy Austin. And specifically, I would point out in the appellate's appendix, pages 73 and 76, he was asked about his conversation with the police officer, and he was asked some of the details about what he told the police and what he denied telling the police officer. And he denied telling the police officer that his brother drove a white Chevy Lumina, which is similar to the car that was at the scene of the crime. He denied telling the police officer that he had a gun before he left Philadelphia. He denied telling the police officer that he used the taxi driver's phone to make a phone call to get the other guy out of the car to come up. And even at one point, he started off denying that he even made a made a statement to the Newcastle County Police, but he cleared that up. He also denied having the telephone call and making a threat to or about Kevin Rafferty before this occurred.
Well, but, given what you just said, when the trial judge made the ruling that they weren't going to let you do this with the police officer because you had to start with Austin, did you say to the trial judge, I've already done that?
Yes. I said that, and then it came out that I had the questions to the police officer had to be framed differently. Didn't you learn in the course of your examination investigation that this occurred? What I preferred and what I wanted to do, didn't Timothy Austin tell you that this happened? Didn't Timothy Austin say this? I think if you look at it, it kind of gets confusing when you think about 3507 and all that. As Justice Berger was, I think, bringing out, when you cross-examine, if you have witnesses, let's say, to a car accident, and the passenger gets out and says to a spectator, or maybe a good Samaritan, my husband was driving drunk. I told him not to drive. He ran the red light. I offered to drive, says it to the good Samaritan. Put her on the stand, she denies it. You put the good Samaritan on the stand, and then you use that witness to impeach her. I don't think you have, it's any more complicated than that. I don't think you have to.
Well, can you help me understand the legal predicate for the introduction of this evidence that you wish to elicit from this police officer? Is it 613? Is it 3507? Or is it something else?
It's not a 35. I wanted to use it to impeach Austin.
Well, I know the purpose. Cite me the rule that authorized this testimony to be
613.
And any particular subpart?
No, I think it's in the beginning. I cited my brief. I think 613, and that you could use extrinsic evidence to impeach.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.
Please rise.